cliffcentral.com.
Stuart Theobald is the chairman of Intellidex, a director at Lariba Consulting, and he's just recently written an article for MoneyWeb in their monthly investment magazine, which everybody's talking about because it addresses some of the things that that make the South African economy so, in inverted commas, special, but in other ways so complex and so complicated. Stuart, it's a pleasure to speak to you this morning. You've spent 16 years looking into financial markets and institutions in Africa, and South Africa's economy at the moment has got to be one of the more interesting examples of how things can both go right and wrong, and sometimes in different proportions. This article that you wrote for MoneyWeb, the reason I suppose everybody's talking about it is because it's both positive and at the same time quite scary. How has it been received from your point of view?
I think feedback has been quite interesting. I think the positive aspects you mention are positives that have existed for a long, long time in the South African economy, which is a strange ability that South Africans have to pull together in the face of a crisis. And the crisis we're facing at the moment is very real at an economic level. The unemployment levels are at historic highs. The foundations of our economy, so key sectors that we've historically been able to rely on, particularly mining, have never looked weaker. Our manufacturing base is in a very weak position. And in the middle of all this, of course, we had a sort of political tsunami with the firing of Nene in December, that really was the last thing we needed. But the interesting thing is the way we respond when we find ourselves facing this kind of crisis. And that's what I really wanted to draw out in this article, that we are pretty good at pulling together. And in fact, a good crisis can sometimes have a galvanizing effect that leaves us, that can leave us better off on a net basis than we ever were. Now, I'm certainly not saying that's where we are, but the fact that South African business has is now cooperating alongside labor with the government more closely than we have in the last 20 years is a very strong sign. It shows a kind of political and social capital at work in the country that might well in the long run lead us to a much better position than we have been.
Well, let's look at those three branches here, as you've already elucidated. We've got government, we've got the unions, labor, organized labor, and then we've got business. How have they been over the last few years in comparison to where they're at now, since the crisis? Because certainly you could say that government was always in cahoots with big business, but you can also equally say that the unions and government are in bed together. So from the outside, over the last 10 to 20 years, it should have been plain sailing because all three of these groups are more or less in cooperation with each other. That's not the truth, though, right?
I don't think so. Let's start with business and labor. Clearly, these are historically two opposed parties. In the kind of standard view, labor and capital are in a constant tension, fighting over the spoils of industrial development. And I think that's a reasonable way to understand the way things have worked in South Africa historically. Business and labor certainly haven't been singing from the same hymn sheet. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, government has focused very much on its own developmental agenda. Often that has been perceived to be at odds to the specific interests of business. And a lot of this is not necessarily a necessary clash. A lot of it is merely cultural. I remember one ANC member of parliament telling me once, the bottom line is that we just didn't go to the same schools. And what he meant was, we just don't know how to communicate with each other and to trust each other. So there always has been a big trust deficit between government and business, that neither side has believed the other one is acting in its interests, or acting so as to assist the other side. And there's been this cultural standoff. Now, I think that's the thing that has shifted, that come December, it became so obvious to all sides that we are now all in the same basket, and you know, we're going to hell in this handbasket if we don't pull together and do something. And the politicians and business people have come together in an unprecedented way to try and build trust between them, and also to build solutions. So there were clear examples of this happening. And, you know, in December, there was a meeting that involved 60 CEOs with key members of National Treasury. In February, there was a meeting in Cape Town just before the budget speech that involved nearly 100 CEOs, as well as the finance minister, the Minister of Trade and Industry, and the president himself. So these have never happened before. This kind of cooperation, both on the side of business, where there is a coordinated set of teams of our most accomplished CEOs busy working together to come up with solutions, and those teams working hand in hand with people from government to do so. That's never happened before. Now, a lot of the focus of this galvanized effect has been the prospect of the ratings downgrades. And ratings downgrades are something that naturally brings business and government together, because everybody is affected by that. A sovereign rating, so the rating of our government's debt, is really a ceiling that everyone else has to operate under. So had we been downgraded, every single company that's raising money on the bond markets gets downgraded simultaneously. So it's just a mechanical feature of the way ratings work. So there's every interest for businesses to work hard alongside government to try and prevent that. And they've succeeded. So we've now had Standard & Poor's, as well as Fitch, come out and maintain their ratings as they are, but in both cases with a negative outlook. So both of them remain on a negative stance towards South Africa. But they've really said, okay, we can see that there is potential to turn the ship around. Now we want to see some of the turning happening, but for now they're leaving things on hold. And that potential to turn the ship around has really come from this remarkable spate of cooperation between business, government, and labor.
Stuart, you seem much more positive than I am. So my concern is that after the credit rating agencies had made their decision, we actually got an GDP contraction number. So in my mind, I don't actually see kind of what the turning point is. You're alluding to the fact that this is the bottom, maybe, and that business and government have got a plan that they're going to work towards to perhaps stop the downgrade in December. Do you think that perhaps they will kind of show us the plan?
Yeah, so let me sound less positive then, because I don't want to sound completely positive. I think what I am positive about here is a certain willingness to cooperate and to interact. But ultimately, that means nothing if it has no effect. And you're right to bring out the GDP number. You know, the ratings agencies are focused on two things primarily: the willingness to pay, and then the ability to pay. The ability to pay is a function of our economic health. And a country with a shrinking GDP, just like anybody who would be who saw their income shrinking would find it harder to pay their debts, exactly the same way South Africa would find it harder to pay its debts. So without doubt, the thing that matters is whether this cooperation and policy approach can translate into genuine economic growth. That's what matters. And we have 6 months to do it, as you say, and the last quarter's GDP figures certainly are not a good way to start.
Stuart, what do we know about the actual decisions and the actual policy reforms that are being tabled, if not policy reforms, the practical steps that we'll take to maintaining this this positive trajectory rather than negative one. What are they agreeing to? What are they agreeing to cooperate on?
So there are two major areas of work that are being done. One is in small business. So, and in the small business area, the specific issue is jobs. Can we get small businesses, which are assumed to be more labor-absorbing than big business? If we can stimulate small business, we can stimulate job creation quicker than anything else. So in small business, so far already, government business have agreed to set up a fund that will invest in businesses that are labor creating. And the agreement is that government will put money into that fund, will match whatever business raises and puts into that fund. Now, business has already raised 1.5 billion rand, and that's just in the last few months. Government is matching that. I've spoken to some business people who think that there are talks on the go that will raise that number up to 5 billion from government. So you potentially collectively have a 10 billion rand jobs fund to invest in businesses that will hire people. And these are funds that have been, this concept has been driven by Adrian Gore, the CEO of Discovery, and Brian Joffe, the CEO of Bidvest. So these are not people, you know, they have a track record of being able to create institutions that can deliver. And this is what they're busy building alongside government to do. So that's a small business area. Then in the big business, there's two ways of thinking about what needs to be done. One is to rescue business or industries that are in trouble. And the other is to stimulate businesses that have the most potential. Businesses in trouble in South Africa, clearly our mining industry is in trouble. Clearly, large parts of our manufacturing base is also in trouble. Now, fixing these problems is largely a function of policy. If you think about mining for a moment, mining industry has faced a legislative change that has hung over it for at least the last 10 years. So there's been an amendment bill to the MPRDA, which is the main legislation governing the mining industry. That amendment bill has been through countless drafts. It's been tabled in both houses of parliament. It's even been sent to the presidency to be signed and then been sent back. It's been split into two and combined into one again. So it's had this life that has just created massive uncertainty over the mining sector. In addition to the MPRDA, there is also uncertainty over the mining charter.
Can I just ask what it is in this bill that is controversial, that's causing back and forth action?
So there's several things. There's an idea about designating certain minerals for price controls, in effect. So that's a main one. There is an idea that government should have the right to buy or should be given a free interest in any gas exploration and development, and have the right to buy further interests. And it's ambiguous as to how that would work. So those are just two aspects, but there are many that have been through various iterations. So the result of this has been massive uncertainty in mining. So investment just hasn't happened. Now, the unfortunate thing is that this process coincided with a great bull market in commodities. We're now in a great bear market for commodities, or starting to come out of one, perhaps. So we've missed a huge investment cycle completely that we could have benefited from. And you can see it when you compare fixed capital investment in South African mining compared to countries like Australia or Canada, where there was just this massive boom. And in South Africa, there just wasn't. So we missed that. But we want to get that right. And if we can get it right, there is locked up investment demand that can be unleashed fairly quickly. So that's the kind of thing that can be fixed in the next 6 months with the right will. So those are industries where we need to do something to defend them. Then in other industries where there is potential for rapid growth, such as tourism, such as business services, so services that we can export to the rest of the world, including, you know, finance and call centers and those kinds of things, there are various strategies being developed to get those right. So in tourism, it's fixing the rather crazy visa regime we implemented and so on. So you can see that there are policy areas that are identified within each of these areas to make a difference, and you know, business and government working together to try and then galvanize an economic response once the policy hurdles are cleared. And each of those involve business people working closely with government people to just figure out exactly how to unblock those. Now, we can be skeptical because government has talked about all kinds of policy things for a long time and then failed to deliver. And certainly it's the delivery that matters, which is why we mustn't for a moment relax. But from what we can tell, from cabinet level down, there is full commitment to do this. And there is certainly, among the business people I've spoken to, a belief that there is genuine interest, genuine intention from government to in fact do it. Now we've got to deliver.
So, Stuart, you talk about the 8-point plan that business has delivered to government. How is that different from the NDP then?
Well, I think a lot of this is continuous with the NDP in some respects. I think the NDP really, when I talk about the cooperation between business and government, the NDP laid the foundation for that kind of cooperation. So that was really when policymaking began to sort of be done in a way that considered business interests directly. And what we're seeing now is kind of far down the road, but now you've encountered a big crisis which requires you to shift certain ambitions and things you're intending to do. And business and government has really pulled together to achieve that shift. But I think there are certain continuity. So the NDP, for instance, has its Bakisa program. That's the sort of model that's being used to accelerate other kinds of industries that we want to drive. So I think the NDP is very important, both in kind of driving that cultural shift, also in some specific policy recommendations. But the 8-point plan is now a more specific focus on dealing with the current crisis.
Sure. So the other thing, Stuart, when you started your article, you wrote about kind of the fact that we have high unemployment and also a stagnating economy. If you added one more thing onto that, the fact that we have high inflation, you're looking at something called stagflation, basically. What are your thoughts on kind of how far away we are from it and how difficult it will be for the country to get out of a stagflationary environment?
Well, I suppose, Adia, you would probably know better than me. I stagflation, the classic example, of course, is Japan. And so for a small country like South Africa, our policy making is, or at least our monetary policy making, has much more scope. And when I say Japan, of course, the problem with Japan is just the inability to stimulate the economy. Whereas South Africa, we're very good at, we're able to drive up inflation fairly easily. Whereas that's really the struggle of the Japanese. We have the scope from a monetary policy point of view to affect inflation quite clearly that other countries don't. So our inflation targeting regime, I think, is largely a matter of managing expectations. And as you know, expectations are really what drive inflation. And I think our Reserve Bank are reasonably good at keeping that under control. Of course, our problem is that a lot of prices at the moment are a function of regulated pricing, particularly energy pricing. And it's very difficult for monetary policy to do anything about that.
And inflation is definitely being driven more by exogenous factors. I almost think that the Saab would do themselves well to get rid of their monetary policy, kind of, you know, this inflation targeting regime at the moment, that it might help. But it is
replace
definitely
it with what? I mean, that's the question, right? Stuart, any ideas on that?
So there's always a debate between inflation and growth. So we have this idea in economics that there's a trade-off. In South Africa, we have, in fact, shifted the Reserve Bank's mandate slightly for monetary policy to be affected by growth fears as well as just inflation fears. And that might, in fact, provide the policy space for the Reserve Bank to be less aggressive with interest rates in order to protect growth. But I think as a general regime, the idea of an inflation target, it's one that's become more and more popular globally. And it does seem to be an effective way of approaching the whole subject. And I mentioned that inflation really is about expectations. So for any of us, if we expect prices to be going up in future, we respond by putting up our own prices. And that's what drives inflation. So the main issue is, how do you manage expectations? And if you have a target, everybody says, well, I could work with that target. And that puts the lid on inflation. If you don't have the target, then you have considerable uncertainty about what inflation will be like in future. And then the temptation is for all of us to put up prices just a little bit more than we would do otherwise, because now we're uncertain about them. So I think as a philosophical approach to dealing with inflation, an inflation targeting regime, I think, is very good. Doesn't necessarily mean that we have to completely ignore growth, and in South Africa we don't ignore growth. And maybe for that reason, at the moment, we might see inflation creep a little bit above the target. But do you always want everyone to expect it to be brought within the target at some point?
Anthony has a question about the minimum wage, which I think is quite interesting. And it's a discussion that's been raging here for years. And we've got a minimum wage now, and supposedly it's going to protect those at the vulnerable end of you know, the labor scale. But there is an argument that also, in order to spur on growth, we should at least mimic some aspects of what the Chinese do in terms of getting more and more people involved in the economy, even if it is at a lower than minimum wage level. And there is, of course, the argument completely against that position, mostly from within the ANC, who have their roots and their coalitions within the labor force. What's your feeling on that, Stuart? I've kind of taken Anthea's question out. I'm sorry.
You didn't want to ask it, though.
Yeah. Yes.
The minimum wage is a difficult topic. And I think there's a lot of sort of noise that gets thrown into the debate when it comes to the actual evidence. For South Africa, we have a jobs crisis. So any policy should be guided first and foremost about what the impact on employment is going to be. Having said that, I think it's too easy to say, well, minimum wages just push up the cost of labor, and therefore we will use less labor within the production mix of most companies. There's plenty of comparative studies of where minimum wages have been introduced that don't support that, that don't see a considerable impact on employment levels after a minimum wage is implemented. My own view, and it's purely kind of speculative because I've not done any research and I haven't read any good research on the question, is that South Africa is a mixed economy. There are certain sectors that are quite elastic in response to prices. So if a minimum wage is imposed, for example, on domestic arrangements, so people using gardeners and cleaners and so on, that is probably quite elastic in response, because there's an easy substitute if those prices go up, which is to do the work yourself.
Yeah. Stuart, is it not a matter of timing and where in the economy you are? So are we in the stage of the economy where we can afford a minimum wage, or are we at the stage in the economy where we just need to do whatever we can to get things going to lower the unemployment rate?
So the issue of affordability, so you can see in that kind of domestic sector how things might work. But in the large corporate sector, how does a big, say, retail firm work? And actually, what I suspect happens is you see shifts in the budgeting around the payroll overall, and you see wages being depressed at high levels in order to support lower levels. So you in fact see a decrease in inequality within a payroll, and that there's some evidence that that's how companies respond when they have minimum wages imposed. And that outcome is probably, you know, in some ways, a good one, particularly, well, from a policy point of view, inequality is also a big problem, as well as unemployment. So that might be a kind of positive consequence of minimum wages. But I think the other one is a very pragmatic positive, which is that in order to get something, you have to give something. And when it comes to labor, what the unions are eager to achieve is a minimum wage. And in return for that minimum wage, we can achieve other amendments to labor policy, particularly better predictability over wage negotiations and minimizing strikes and the impact of strikes on the economy. And this seems to be what's happening, is that there's a trade-off going on between accepting minimum wages in return for labor policy amendments that will reduce the damage that strikes can do to the economy. And the net outcome might well be positive for us. In fact, I think it's probably positive for us. So even though we can quibble over minimum wages and what the economic impact will be, just as a matter of pragmatic real politic, the overall outcome of accepting them in return for other concessions is likely to be positive.
Stuart, so I was wondering, in your discussions with these business people and through your interviews, was there at any stage a consideration to let industries that were failing go? So you spoke about supporting the mining industry because resources now obviously are in the trough, commodities were struggling. I'm not sure commodities are turning, so I don't think we're going to see a huge spike in the commodity prices in the short term. What, at any stage, did business people or government say or even think about the idea of just letting that sector go and maybe creating other sectors that would be more beneficial? Or is it too long term?
So I think you're raising a very good point there. We should not be in the business of pouring good money after bad. And where there are industries that are unsustainable, the right thing is to let them go. And to focus instead on businesses where we are competitive and that do have major growth potential. And I think, you know, globally, there not just South Africa, but, you know, the UK as well, is grappling with what to do about its steel industry, for example. In South Africa, we are just not producing steel at competitive pricing. And it's unclear that we ever should. That we will be able to in future. And as you say, and I agree with you, the commodities trough that we're in is certainly not going to be a spike. So we're never going back to 2008. Those days are gone. But we might, and what my view is that we see a very, that we might be at a bottom, and we see a very gradual, a much slower price movement in future, because we've had a huge supply reduction. And now we're in a process of production efficiencies being implemented that are actually quite effective worldwide. So steel might be a terminal industry for countries like South Africa. It's just no scenario in which it's going to be profitable again. And that's not something you want to be protecting. But what we see in mining is not really that scenario, because we're seeing an investment strike happening simply because of policy uncertainty. So this isn't just the economics of the industry. This is now the policy that surrounds the industry. And policy is something you can fix without trying to sustain unsustainable industries. And it's really the policy environment that we have to get right. I don't think, it's a very good thing, even though it's tempting sometimes for politicians to come up with rescue deals, that to my mind is very, very seldom something that makes sense. You should let the economics work, but letting the economics work actually means getting the policy right. and we're not in a position where we can say we have the policy right.
I'm interested in what you're studying. You're doing a doctorate in philosophy at the London School of Economics on philosophical problems in finance. You're dealing with the ontology of financial institutions. So you're actually looking at the whole system from the top down and the methodology of theoretical finance. How do you begin to explain that to someone at a dinner party? I mean, when someone asks you, what do you do? And someone says, oh, I'm a plumber. And someone else says, oh, I'm in advertising. And you tell them, I'm busy writing my doctorate in ontology of financial institutions and the methodology of theoretical finance. How well does it go after that?
Well, I don't get invited back, Gareth. You see, now I'm afraid you're going to repeat exactly that scenario when it comes to getting back on Cliff Central.
No, absolutely not. I'm actually very interested in this because there's been an enormous amount of upheaval. And Anthea and I were talking this morning about how if you'd invested $5,000 in Amazon, 1997 when they listed, it would be worth $2 million now. And that through all the upheavals of the various financial crises, the big banking debacles, do we need new words and do we need new terms to describe financial institutions? Are we discovering better ways of making sense of capitalism?
So I think we are discovering better ways of making sense of capitalism every day. I mean, to talk a little bit about my research. So you mentioned on the ontology of the financial system is, right. is one question. The second question is the epistemology of it. So let me explain what that means. So the ontology is really about what actually exists.
Yeah.
And when we talk about society, we don't think about this very much until we stop and think about it. But it's quite remarkable how certain things exist simply because we all believe they exist. So money, for example, the cash in your wallet is really just bits of paper that have a certain kind of printing on. But everybody knows that it's also money, that it has this particular status. And we all simultaneously believe it has that status without really trying. And you might think that, oh, well, central banks issue money and governments write laws that say what give money certain powers and things. But there's loads of examples where you don't need the central banks or the governments, and money still somehow exists within societies, and it's existed for as long as we're able to go backwards.
And its most recent incarnation has got to be this Bitcoin revelation.
Yeah, Bitcoin, so you don't even need notes and coins for money to exist. But we have this remarkable ability as human beings interacting with each other for these things to become true. And that's a quite mysterious capability and property of societies. And philosophers are interested in that. So I wanted to use these debates to try and understand more about the financial system, because it's also quite remarkable that we have stock exchanges, we have these things called banks, we have central banks, and all of these function in this kind of realm of mutual beliefs that people in a society have about them. And I have an argument that when financial crises arise, they're partly crises of belief. And when we understand that the ontology of the financial system really is this feature of people's beliefs, and we then try and make sense of crises as shifting beliefs, and I'm trying to develop an account of how that happens. So that's the ontology of the system, and then philosophers talk about epistemology, which is what we know or how we know about the system, what kind of properties does it have. Now economists are really in the business of studying the economy and building theories about what happens and how things work in the economy. And partly I'm interested in sort of fundamental questions about that process. So what counts as evidence for economists? What kind of reasoning do economists use? So, you know, we're quite used to the idea of scientists as people who do experiments and who rely on empiricism to prove or disprove claims that they might be making.
How do economists do the same thing? Do they do experiments? Do they rely purely on data? You know, we often talk about economics having a lot of mathematics in it. What does the mathematics do? I mean, theoretical physics also has a lot of mathematics in it. And sometimes in economics, you hear people criticize it for the amount of mathematics. And I'm interested in understanding that. Why do we use maths?
Stuart, are you questioning that the financial system and the stability of the financial system is based on trust? Because that's kind of what it is, isn't it? And so in 2008, 2009, when
we had a crisis
the trust,
of confidence.
That's right. The trust between banks fell apart. Is that part of your study? And how do you quantify something like that?
So, you know, when I talk about that kind of recognition and beliefs being the basis on which social reality rests, trust is certainly a part of that. So we have trust in each other, being able to meet contract terms and so on. That is fundamental for all kinds of things, including markets, to work. But trust isn't the sum of it. So there are also interesting features of social reality that happen in the absence of trust, and even in the absence of belief. So an economic recession, for instance, is a good example where we can be in it without anybody being aware of it. So you might think of this as a fallout from other sorts of things that we are aware of. So we might all individually be fearful about the future, and so we become more conservative in our spending and saving decisions. And as a fallout of enough people doing that, you end up with a recession. So there are various features that where trust, we can say, is very important in supporting markets, because we've got these obligations that people have to meet. It's not the whole story. Trust is sort of driven in turn by the consequences of default. So if we fail to live up to an obligation we have, what consequences are there on us? So we have to have beliefs in the system as well as beliefs in the other counterparty and what they might do.
And are you indeed kind of comparing the different economic systems? So would you compare Keynesian economics to anything different? Is that where your thesis is going?
How about this for an even more sort of pedestrian profundity? Was Adam Smith right? I mean, how about that? Let's cut to the chase here.
So,
who has the best original idea? Come on, you're studying this stuff, Stuart. Give me a quick answer on this.
So, I think look at the list of Nobel Prizes to see good original ideas. I think there are lots of good ideas. I think one of the things that makes economics different to something like physics is that there is no sort of slam dunk experiment to prove something right. Yeah. So there is no
and human failing and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and you know, really, economics I like to think of as a library of theories. So physics you can think of as sort of progressive. Mm-hmm. So we had kind of Newtonian and then Einstein and then quantum, whereas economics is a laterally growing topic. So it constantly develops new ways of analyzing the same thing. And it's not necessarily that one is right and one is wrong. It's just that some are more applicable in certain situations than others. So you know, we have lots of different models to explain, for instance, how unemployment works and what the consequences of long-term unemployment are. Now, which is the right model is actually something you have to do a lot of work, a lot of theoretical and empirical work to understand which models should be applied. And if you're an economist, your approach should really be to have a library full of potential models that you can draw on in order to understand something that's happening in reality in front of you. And that's largely because economic theories work as little abstractions. Hmm. You know, so if you think of that classic demand and supply curves, you sort of learn the first thing one learns in economics. This is a very abstract way of understanding the world that that suppliers will produce more if prices are high, and purchasers or consumers will consume more if prices are low. And what happens in a market is that prices end up being where these two tendencies meet each other in the middle. And so you have this very abstract world, very simplistic world that doesn't actually exist anywhere. But it kind of tells us something about the way economies work. It tells us something real about them. But there's no market in that exists anywhere where it works just like that, that these curves and these simple dimensions apply. Stuart, so,
I'm almost concerned that with our earlier discussion on stagflation, that we might have to adopt the Japanese prime minister's Abenomics. I mean, this is like it just could go round and round. I'm not sure that there's a real answer, is there? Unless it's kind of looking back on it historically, maybe.
I think they're real answers, and I think, but I think the theoretical body of economics is not where the answer. Well, I think the theoretical body is not something that is going to just deliver a ready-made answer. So theoretical work tells us all kinds of stuff about what tendencies exist in economies. But to find a real situation, South Africa, 2016, unemployment rates of near on 30%, inflation, what are the things that are causing these factors? There's no economic theory that has the answer ready made for us. We've got to look to all of the tendencies that economics can tell us are at work in this economy and do the hard work of saying, well, these are the tendencies that are giving us these negative outcomes that we want to address. This is what's happening in front of us right now. So I sometimes get frustrated when we it's easy to have arguments about great sweeping ideological positions in economics, you know, capitalism versus or even Keynesian versus neoclassicism. And to me, these are not very helpful debates. Really, those particular schools
gave us,
they gave us lots of models, lots of tools to use to understand the world. And I don't want to get into the debate about whether your tool is neoclassical and mine is Keynesian.
Right.
I want to get into the debate about what's happening in South Africa. But then, have these economic outcomes.
Stuart, hurry up and build the model. I mean, let's just have a computer that we put in the growth numbers, we put in the unemployment numbers, and it figures it out for us. I mean, come on.
Yeah, if only.
No pressure.
Unfortunately, economies are just, you know, I can predict which way billiard balls are going to go when you strike them on the table. But economies are just so much more complex. There is no way you can do that kind of predictive work.
So in the end, we have you telling us that we actually know some things, but we don't know everything, and we're a little bit further than knowing nothing. Is that about it?
I think that's right. That's right. That's a good way of putting it.
I thought a little distillation might be in order. But thank you so much, Stuart, and well done on the article, which has got everybody talking and which I encourage everyone to read. It was in MoneyWeb. It's also, you've got a weekly column in Business Day focused on financial services, and the Business Day Investors Monthly was your project. You founded that, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, there we go.
Lots of years gone by.
Yeah, lots of homework for us to do there, and thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Stuart Theobald, IntelliDex. Thank you very much to Anthea Gardner, too. CliffCentral.com.